It's 7:30 on this West Virginia morning. I'm Beneduccio. The future of Marshall University football is looking bright.
I mean, I think expectations here are extremely high. You know, that's when I came here, that's what we expected to get done, you know, is to be able to have people talking about us prior to the season, and guess what they are.
The story on this West Virginia morning. It's 7:30. I'm Beneduccio. This is West Virginia Morning. A new tool to train riverboat workers allows trainees to smack into bridges and barges without risking millions of dollars in damages. Glennis Board has more from the Inland Waterways Academy in Huntington.
State Port of Huntington is the largest inland port in America, bigger than Baltimore, and bigger than Philadelphia, based on the tonnage that travels through. That river activity accounts for more than $1.5 billion of West Virginia's economy, as well as some 10,000 jobs. And the inland maritime industry is projecting a 1.5% growth annually over the next decade. The Inland Waterways Academy has been training folks to fill these river jobs, everything from deckhands to captains, for the past 14 years. And now they're equipped with a training tool that the school's director, John Whiteley, says is only one of a handful throughout the country.
This is your con. It shows you your speed, your direction, your throttle settings, your rudder angle indicator, everything like that. Gives you your heading, your speed over the ground, set and drift, which if you're not a sailor, you probably don't know what it is.
Whiteley is the executive director of workforce development for Mount West Technical and Community College, in addition to being the director of the Inland Waterways Academy at Mount West. He's standing at the helm of a faux pilot house, throttles in front of him, surrounded by screens that show a Coast Guard boat and choppy waters in all directions.
So we're coming into Brunswick, Georgia, which is the submarine base. We have a radar display that actually indicates what you would see on the radar in this area. The next thing up there is an electronic chart that tells you where you are.
Whiteley says he and his staff have just finished training on the simulator so they can now begin to train students and offer opportunities for experienced boat workers to get additional training too.
And the instructor who's sitting outside the wheelhouse can give it a steering failure, an engine failure, a fire in the engine room, a lot of different scenarios to see how the trainee is going to react to it. Mm-hmm. And we're filming the trainee all the time. When the scenario is done, we then take them into a debrief room, and we can show them what they did and talk them through it, and that's where the learning actually takes place.
He says while the simulator doesn't physically move, the 180-degree visuals leave many rocking back and forth nonetheless.
I used to be in the Coast Guard, and I lived on Governor's Island in New York. And New York was one of the model ports that we had. And I actually, going up the upper bay, went past Governor's Island. I could see the building I lived in. I could see the windows of my apartment. They're that realistic. The people from Transys, which is the company that we bought it from, they will actually go down the river on a boat and take photographs of everything around. Mm-hmm. And then they'll also model the river itself, the depths and things like that. Of course, you've got all the bends and everything. Mm-hmm. And the boat will react the way a normal boat would react.
Whiteley talks about Cincinnati, for example, that has five bridges, none of which line up, and how much training it takes to be able to navigate through. He even let me steer a tugboat.
Sure.
And you can see that you're actually starting to move a little bit to starboard, but we aren't going to make it.
Aren't?
Nope.
No.
We're having a collision.
What happens when you have a collision?
It just stops the exercise.
Okay.
Collision with a target.
See? But see, when you have a collision, you just start it all over again.
Well, I will stick to navigating through radio waves. For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Glennis Board in Huntington.
A bill introduced in the Senate is meant to help prevent the drastic change in gasoline prices seen regionally throughout the state. Ashton Morrow reports.
Senate Bill 368 repeals sections of code dating back to the late 1930s that Senator Herb Snyder says is causing unfair trade practices across West Virginia. The section says all retailers selling any type of merchandise must charge 7% over what they paid at wholesale. Put on the books in 1939, the senator calls it outdated, citing prices of major commodities like a gallon of gasoline at 10 cents, the average home price at $3,500, and the average car costing $700. Snyder says 25 years ago, gas and oil companies used this very section of code to file suit against each other when some retailers were offering lower prices at the pump. He says by staying on the books, the law doesn't allow mom-and-pop stores to compete with the major chains and is hurting West Virginians.
It's time for us to repeal this law because it has hurt the citizens of West Virginia. Not just the Eastern Panhandle, where the prices today are 26 cents higher. It's hurt the citizens of this state for about 25 years to not allow those particularly used, it's a general law on all merchandise, but it's particularly used by the gas retailers. Now, they're going to tell you it's complex and you can't understand it. But this is the area of law. It took us a while to find it. That those lawsuits were filed.
Snyder says the lawsuits were sealed, making it more difficult to find the specific section of code retailers were citing. He adds those filing suit under the section don't have to prove damages, making it easier for retailers to win cases and push the prices higher. For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Ashton Mara in Charleston.
You're listening to West Virginia Morning at 7:37.
In the weather forecast for West Virginia, increasing cloudiness today with high temperatures ranging from the mid-30s in the northern panhandle to the mid-40s in the southwest. Tonight, cloudy with lows in the 20s. And for midweek, the polar vortex returns to West Virginia. Tomorrow, it's going to be cloudy with snow likely. A few inches of snow accumulation is possible. Temperatures will continue falling into the teens by afternoon or evening. And tomorrow night, partly cloudy and quite cold, with lows ranging from 5 to 5 degrees below zero. We have support provided by Davis and Elkins College, presenting an evening of Celtic rock with Gaelic Storm at 7:30 p.m. March 21st in the Miles Center for the Arts. Details at dewv.edu.
A 31-20 victory over the University of Maryland in the Military Bowl has many around the Marshall University football program excited about next season. Clark Davis has the story on the program that is ready to take the next step.
With much of the team returning for the 2014 season after finishing 10-3, expectations are high for the Thundering Herd football team. Many have predicted top 25 rankings for the squad. Others have predicted they'll win the conference. Marshall head coach Doc Holliday says high expectations are good for his team.
I think expectations here are extremely high. That's when I came here, that's what we expected to get done, is to be able to have people talking about us prior to the season, and guess what they are? Bottom line is, somebody telling you you're going to be a top 25 team, that's not what gets you there. It's, the work and everything goes along with it, but, we can't become complacent.
The 10-win season was the first time since 2002 that a Marshall team finished with double-digit victories. It also marked the first Conference USA East Division crown for the school, and its first trip to the Conference USA championship game where they would lose to Rice. In the final USA Today coaches poll, the Thundering Herd finished 29th. Holliday says three things will determine how successful the team can be next year.
Number one is complacency. If you think you arrived, you haven't. We can't let them become selfish, and selfishness comes in a lot of different ways. It's thinking more about yourself and the team and making bad decisions. Everything goes along with it, not just stats and that kind of thing. And, of course, accountability and everything you do. There's a direct correlation on how your team acts off the field, how accountable they are, and how they play on the field.
The 5-win improvement from 2012 to 2013 has many wondering what could happen in 2014 with a schedule that looks favorable for an experienced team like the Herd to make a serious run. With non-conference matchups with Ohio University, Miami, Ohio, and Kent State University. Fans are looking forward to the season. Holiday says when he looks at his team this offseason, he sees a vastly different group than last offseason.
You know, I just thought to myself, you know, we're so much further ahead than we were this time last year. You know, I looked out there a year ago, and I didn't see what I see right now, which is a good thing, and it's going to be important. One of the reasons we had success we had, won the number of games we won, was because of the leadership that took place and because of the kind of team we became.
Holiday hopes that the success of this past season mixed with high expectations have an impact as he and his coaches hit the road to finish up recruiting for next year before the national signing period begins February 5th.
You know, the one thing about Marshall University and the football program, it's got great tradition. I mean, you walk into a lot of, in almost every home out there, you know, they can tell you about the number of wins they had in the 90s and early 2000s and the Randy Mosses and Chads and Byrons and on and on and on. And we're getting back to that. You know, they had the opportunity, you know, against Maryland, the Military Bowl, was seeing, you know, a football team go out and beat a BCS team and play extremely well.
That's when athletes can sign on the dotted line, committing themselves to a college football program. The Military Bowl was Marshall's second bowl win in three seasons. The Herd beat FIU in the 2011 Beef O'Brady's Bowl. For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Clark Davis in Huntington.
If you've ever driven through Randolph County, West Virginia on U.S. Route 219, you've probably passed the towns of Daly, East Daly, and Valley Bend, just 10 miles south of Elkins. Most people probably don't realize that these towns have a unique history behind them. The Tigert Valley Homestead was built in the 1930s as part of a larger government project to provide relief to unemployed and stranded families during the Great Depression. The Traveling 219's Dan Schultz has more.
If you go to the website of the Library of Congress, you can browse through dozens of black and white photographs depicting rural life in the Tigert Valley in Randolph County, West Virginia, in the 1930s and 40s. The photos portray almost every aspect of life in the communities that made up the Tigert Valley homestead. Busy men working in a woodworking shop, a meeting of a women's club, children in a nursery. Many of the photos depict the landscape of the valley, scattered with uniform-looking, pristine Cape Cod-style homes and buildings of modern industry among the farmland and distant mountains. Today, you can still find many of these original buildings if you're driving by on U.S. Route 219. But before the 1930s, none of this was here. The valley was a sparsely populated wetland when the federal government initiated a new program designed to relocate struggling and impoverished families to new communities under a unique vision during the Great Depression. Jerry Thomas is a retired professor of history from Shepherd University. Jerry has focused a lot of his work on West Virginia during the Great Depression of the 1930s.
Most influenced by Quaker ideas, the dream was that workers or farmers placed on productive agricultural land could raise crops and food for subsistence, and also work in nearby industries or industries that they themselves could generate, they would always have enough food, and if the industrial work was slow to recover in the area, they or their families could get together and engage in handicrafts to generate cash income.
Josephine Vanskoy grew up at the homestead after her family was selected for the new relief program.
Oh, yes. They started that 1934 selecting them for the homestead. And it was 298 or 300 people selected for the houses that they were going to build. And everybody had to help. And they made about 30 or 40 cents an hour.
Josephine's father, Frank, was a carpenter who had worked for the CCC and at a lumber mill in the neighboring county. Homesteaders were chosen partly for their work experience, since they would be employed in constructing the homestead homes and the community buildings. The homestead had been envisioned as a cooperative community, and a 550-acre cooperative farm was established there in 1935. A handsome stone trade center, which today houses the local post office, was also constructed to help residents participate in trade for the products they produced at the homestead.
And then they did have a weaving shop here where the women came down here daily and wove articles. They wove rugs, scarves, aprons, and then the men had a woodworking shop down here daily where they made items, small items. And they taught men to do those things for their own home. See, they finally built a mill over here, and a lot of the men went to work in mills.
The lumber mill was one of the biggest successes of the Tiger Valley homestead. The federal government built 99 other planned communities around the country during the 1930s, and many other homesteads failed to attract industry to their communities, which was a large component of the initial vision for the self-sustaining homestead projects. At Tiger Valley, the lumber mill employed 150 residents and helped reinvigorate the timber industry in the area. Despite this, from the beginning, there was a lot of opposition to the whole idea of a government-funded and sponsored homestead community project. Many people saw the project as utopian and a waste of resources.
Also, the political opposition was intense. Many businessmen believed it inappropriate for government to promote industrial activities in competition with existing businesses. And generally, the business community thought that this whole idea of a subsistence homestead smacked of socialism. With the coming of World War II, the government quickly rid itself of the properties and went out of the subsistence homestead business.
In the 1940s, after only 10 years, the homestead community and trade buildings were sold off, and residents were able to buy their homes for around $3,000, when the national average home price was closer to $10,000. From the proceeds of these sales, the community was able to repay the federal government the sum of their entire loans over the homestead's 10-year existence. This makes the Tiger Valley Homestead one of the success stories of the homestead experiments, as well as the New Deal project in general. But for folks like Josephine Vanskoy, who never left Tiger Valley, the homestead was about more than numbers. It was about improving the lives of American families in some of the hardest hit places in the midst of the worst economic disaster in the nation's history, about pulling people together and giving them a chance to build their own communities and work towards owning their own homes.
See, we had running water and electric and a big garden, and the men had steady work, and they helped build their own homes, which they were proud of. I'm not ashamed of being a Tiger Valley homesteader, because my parents, it was seven children, and he didn't have much work, and we were renting, and we didn't have a whole lot, and we were one of the few selected.
This story was produced by Dan Schultz of the Traveling 219 Project, a production of Allegheny Mountain Radio with the support from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the West Virginia Humanities Council, and AmeriCorps Vista. To learn more, go to traveling219.com and go to Facebook. West Virginia Morning is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, which is solely responsible for its content. Keep up with the latest West Virginia news throughout the day on our website, wvpublic.org. Find great stories, photos, and videos, and you can subscribe to our West Virginia Morning podcast. We're interested in your comments. You can send them to feedback@wvpublic.org. Support for West Virginia Public Broadcasting's news bureaus comes from Shepherd University, West Virginia University, Marshall University, and Concord University. Our news director is Beth Voorhees. Our director is Chuck Anzalevich. From Morgantown, I'm Beneduccio. Good morning.